everybody. I'm still getting used to my new theme song. I'm Beatty Cohn-Vretos, and welcome, welcome, welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beatty Show. And for those of you who may be tuning in for the very first time and you're wondering, what is the Ask Beatty Show and who is Beatty Cohn-Vretos? Well, I am a psychotherapist, and I'm also a sex therapist. And I am the author of the groundbreaking book, a book that I wish I certainly had when I was starting my own relationship life many, many years ago. The book is For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And why this is such an important book is that I actually did research with 450 people in the Boston, Providence, and Connecticut areas. And through the research, I developed a 10-step formula. And for people who know me, they know that I am very, very bottom line. If things don't work, let's just not waste our time talking about it. But what this formula does is that it helps all of us to accurately assess who is right for us and who is wrong for us before committing to any serious relationship. And people always, always ask me, well, can you somehow fast forward this process? Can I really, really know who she is or who he is in a couple of weeks or a couple of months? Well, my answer, my friends, is absolutely not. In fact, the research found that it actually takes close to a year to find out who somebody is and who somebody is not. In fact, before I did the book and before I did the research, in my past usual spontaneous way, I would meet somebody and I would say, what a lovely woman, or what a lovely, trustworthy person. Well, of course, what I've learned over all of these years is that I would never, ever, ever make that kind of a statement today. So I'll ask my patients all the time. By the way, I have a private practice here in New York City and also in East Hampton. So I'll ask my patients, you know, when I go through all of this, what would I say? And of course, what I would say is that, and what I'm hoping that you will say moving forward after you read the book, is that I've met someone who appears to be lovely, who appears to be trustworthy. And of course, using the formula and taking the time, which is going to take you probably close to a year, unless you find that there are a lot of red flags, in which case you're not going to waste your time or spend your time, you know, just staying in a relationship for the course of a year, then you are going to have a very, very clear sense of who this person is and who this person is not. So what do we do here on the Ask Beatty Show? Well, we talk about love. Yes, love is still alive and well, despite the fact that we hear so many horrific stories about the divorce rate and domestic violence rates in this country. But we do. We talk about love. We talk about healthy love. We talk about relationships. We talk about sexuality. And of course, we talk about mental health issues. And I want you to know something, is that everybody, whether or not you think that people may have the perfect life and have all the money and education in the world, you know, and I'm thinking, of course, about the Bill and Melinda Gates divorce, you know, people were so shocked. And the fact is that none of us will ever, ever know what really goes on behind closed doors. We simply will not know. But my mantra, and of course, my mantra as a psychotherapist and sex therapist now for over 35 years, has always been to try to acknowledge and address and take whatever steps we need to take to resolve our own issues and our relationship issues as best as possible. Because we don't want to live a life where our issues and our traumas are continuing to get in the way of our lives and of our relationships. And what I hope that I've convinced you over the years, today I believe is the 345th, the 345th or 346th Ask Beattie show here that I've done on the Progressive Radio Network. And I really hope that I have convinced you that we do not need to take life's journey on our own. It is way too difficult. And the important thing for all of us to remember is to really give ourselves permission and do what is in our best interest. Is that when troubles and problems are really taking over our life, to reach out to family. Hopefully, you have supportive family. And if you don't, then hopefully you have friends. And if need be, it is a good thing then to reach out to a professional because our life journey is going to be a lot easier if we do not feel so isolated and alienated and lonely. Because let's look at the reality of what is going on in this country. If we're talking about depression in the United States, and this is a statistic that I've been using now for a couple of years, and I really think that this number has certainly grown, certainly in the past year with the pandemic. But 17 million adults in the United States suffer and truly suffer from depression, which actually translates into 7.1% of all adults. And that number for women is 8.7%. And studies show that females experience, or at least we express symptoms of depression as roughly 2 times the rate for men. And if we're looking at anxiety disorders, 14 million Americans are suffering from a variety of anxiety disorders and domestic violence. And we need to be talking about these issues and not be embarrassed to put them out. And I think that more and more we are, as a society, certainly in the United States, starting to talk about mental health and the importance of seeking mental health treatment. Because if we're looking at domestic violence statistics, it's hard to believe, but it's a fact that 4 women are killed every single day by their intimate partner. And of course, this is not about blaming anybody, but this is exactly why I wrote the book. And I wrote the book for my daughter, Jordana, because I want all of us to have a sense of empowerment. And empowerment only comes with education, with education. So that is why, when we're assessing doctors or dentists, we're reading reviews and we're looking at likes. It's the same kind of thing that we need to do when we are assessing potential partners, because these days we assess everything. And yet when it comes to looking at our relationships, the term assessment, it's hardly romantic and it's hardly sexy, and yet it is critical. It is critical that when we are letting people into our life, that we give ourselves as much time and we give ourselves as much information as possible. And in that way, we are going to keep ourselves safe. And if we're looking at suicide, my friends, is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States for all ages. And suicide is the second, you may be really surprised to hear this, but suicide is the second leading cause of death in the world for those aged 15 to 24. And I don't want to depress you, but I mean, the facts are the facts. And this is why. When we're starting to struggle, when we're starting to struggle, the importance of acknowledging and addressing and resolving and giving ourselves permission to reach out and ask for help, which is why early identification, and this should be beginning in the schools, is so critical. Years and years ago, I was one of three people who was the director of the Greater Montreal School Social Services Program. And it was a wonderful thing. We had school social workers in all of the Greater Montreal schools, and we were there for several days a week. And we worked as a team with the psychologists and the teachers and the nurses, so that when staff would identify kids that were at risk, kids that were struggling, kids who were depressed, kids who were having social problems, there was no question. There was no question that there were professionals there who would be able to do really good assessments. And in that world, at that time, no child was really left behind. So again, early identification and early treatment is critical, because if we let it go, years and years and years can pass. And at some point, the bubble is going to burst. And then we wonder, well, how could that possibly have happened? Well, typically, issues begin at early stages of life, which is why kids in schools, and this is where we should be spending a tremendous amount of money, putting these kinds of supportive counseling resources into our schools. So let's talk a little bit about divorce. And again, I think that some of you may be surprised at these statistics, that the divorce rate for first marriages is 48%. 67% of people marrying for the second time divorce. And one would hope, or one would wish, that people do better in third and fourth marriages, but the divorce statistic for third marriages happens to be 74%. In fact, I had hosted a call-in counseling show in Providence, Rhode Island on WPRO a number of years ago, and it was a call-in counseling show. And a man called me and he said, "Beatie, guess what? I have been married three times. I married a blonde, I married a redhead, and I married a brunette." And in talking with this man, the only thing that really changed was the women's color of the hair, that the basic dynamics remained identical from one marriage to another. Some other statistics that I do want to share with you, and that happens to be in the area of teenage dating violence. I mean, when I was a teenager growing up in Winnipeg, Canada, I mean, that was something. I mean, it was never talked about. It was never heard. One wonders whether some of this may have been going on. But here we have statistics where nearly 1 in 11 females and approximately 1 in 14 male high school students report having experienced physical dating violence. And this is in the last year. And about 1 in 8 females and 1 in 26 male high school students report having experienced sexual dating violence. And one in three girls in the United States is a victim of physical, emotional, or verbal abuse from a dating partner. So we need to do a lot better job when it comes to relationship education. And when we're talking about teenage dating violence, what was really interesting was that 81% of parents believe that teen dating violence is not an issue at all. And my weekly reminders, of course, about improving your day-to-day life, having to do with good diet, plant-based diets. Of course, we hear this from Dr. Gary Null every single day, and making sure that we exercise and we get enough sleep and we have supportive people in our life. And of course, remembering to eliminate toxins, including toxic people. And of course, that sometimes means friends and family. So that basically every single day, and this is something that I try to communicate to every single patient that I treat, regardless of what, in quotes, the diagnosis is to, as we navigate our days, to try to think about the things that we can do that are really in our best interest, and to be mindful and to ask ourselves the question, is this something that is good for me, or is this something that is actually destructive or self-destructive? So it's not easy. It's not easy living in these times. And of course, if you talk to people from earlier times and earlier centuries, whoever said that life was going to be a breeze. But I think again that it's just so important to be able to surround yourself with positive people, so that when things get tough, that you know that it is okay, that you can, ask for help, and that you have people in your life, hopefully, that will be there to lend a hand. Well, today we are going to be talking about the African American experience in terms of mental health. And African Americans are experiencing a tsunami of information and negative impacts on their mental health. And there are simply, I mean, come on, all we have to do is just turn on our television sets and read the newspapers. There are simply too many traumatic, violent, and racially charged situations impacting African Americans' mental health. And the pandemic has further impacted mental health concerns that include depression, anger, anxiety, loneliness, and isolation. And actually, I was looking at this statistic a couple of days ago, that between 1991 and 2017, suicide attempts among Black adolescents has been increased by 73%. Well, I have a terrific, terrific guest who I am so excited to introduce to you. But before I introduce Colette, we're going to listen to a really beautiful song, and I want you to take the words in. "Somebody's Hurting My Brother" by Yara Allen. Well, this is the whole thing, is that it has gone on for far, far, far too long. And my guest today, and I'm so pleased to have her as a guest, is Colette Winlock. And Colette is a published author. Her first novel, Undoing Crazy, deals with the effects of racism and depression on an African American family living in Oakland. And she is currently working on her second novel. And Colette has worked with mental health and substance abuse prevention and early intervention services for over 40 years. And for 10 years, she was the executive director for Oakland, California Health and Human Services Education Center's Black Women's Media and Wellness Project, and worked for 5 years and directed the National Black Alcoholism Council in California. She's also worked as the health director for the Bay Area Black United Fund for 8 years, where she headed up the Harriet Tubman Critical Mass Health Conductors and the Bay Area African American Health Summit. And Colette holds degrees in kinesiology and cultural anthropology. And this was something that I was really excited to read about Colette, that she is in multiple sports hall of fames for track and field and an inductee into the Women's Hall of Fame. So Colette, welcome, my dear, to the Ask Beattie Show. How are you today?
Hi, Dee Dee. It is so good to be back talking with you. I'm doing really well.
Well, and
It's a
I have to apologize about something, Colette. I had expected, I sent the link for the music to my producer, and I had actually expected that the music was going to start to play in the beginning. So I'm not sure, were you actually able to hear the words of the song?
I was able to hear it, and definitely profound words. And I think that was a good lead-in for the conversation that we're going to have.
Well, that's for sure. We're going to have, it's funny. I was talking to my husband, Jim, before the show. He is a sociologist, and he's the host of the Radical Imagination. And it was because of him. He was actually watching a webinar, Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth webinar, that, of course, Fonya Davis, who's the
Oh,
executive director, that she
yes.
had. Right. And that was how I found you, because what I wanted to do, and I think that there are so many people, you know, like myself, of course, I consider myself Canadian, but, you know, white Americans who are just not sure and just not comfortable about having really honest, frank discussions about what is going on in the African American psyche and spirit and world here in the United States. And I sent out, this was after the webinar, I actually sent out an email asking whether or not people would be interested in talking with me and coming on the show. And I don't know whether I told you this, but you were the only person who responded. And then we had this lovely Zoom conversation. And I'm so grateful and happy that you've agreed to do this, because we all have a great deal to learn about each other, right?
Oh, without a doubt, for sure. And I appreciated you putting that call out, you know, asking for presenters. And, you know, I don't know, I'm in a semi-retirement state right now, so I have a lot more time on my hands than I had, you know, about 6 months ago. And it's true, 40 years of working in the mental health field and paying attention to what's happening to African Americans' mental health. I feel like we're at a moment in time right now that, as bad as it is, I do have a level of hopefulness. I was talking to some clinicians the other day, and we were talking about the stigma that's associated within the African American community about getting, you know, clinical support, seeing a therapist, you know, participating in support groups. And what they were saying, and I believe as well, is that because things are so bad right now, and they're so out loud with the amount of violence and trauma that African Americans are experiencing as a result of as a result of white supremacy, as you put in your questions, has become much broader known. And so my hope is that what I'm hearing from my friends, family, is that we are definitely understanding the impact on our mental health. And so there's
And you know, mm-hmm. what was really interesting is on May the 10th in the New York Times, I don't know whether you happened to read the piece, there was an article, "After a Traumatizing Year, Black People Turn to Therapy." So it says the death of George yes. Floyd and other high profile police killings have actually prompted, and I guess I would say too, given permission to African Americans to seek help, mental health experts are saying. Are you finding that it is more okay, that it is more acceptable, that there is now less of a stigma really for all of us to reach out and ask for help, particularly during these difficult times?
I do agree. That's what I was indicating, is that I do believe that the end result of all this is that you can see it online. You can see it in social media. There's various support groups that are happening. Clinicians are talking about having an increase in their, in their clientele. So that's kind of, it's a good outcome. I have a great deal of sadness about what's driven it. Right. But I'm happy about what's starting to occur.
No, exactly. And I think for the audience, and I think just for all of us, I mean, we need a good understanding of what systemic racism really is in this country. And if anybody can explain it, I think that you're a wonderful spokesperson for the cause.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I've had lived experience of what's happened, you know, around racism. I grew up in Charleston, South Carolina, back during the 60s, and I experienced the white and colored drinking fountains, the segregated schools, the KKK marching, you know, within the city area. And so those have been experiences that I have found myself that I had to actually do some work to undo what trauma had been stored in my body. A lot of it is fear. It's fear about, am I going to be able to control the situation? Am I really safe? And I'm glad you identify yourself as a white Canadian, because I realized as I grew up, I began to start asking, so what type of white person are you? You know,
yes.
Are you the ones that I
yes.
saw when I was a child? And so that's something that, you know, black folks are constantly having to do calculus to understand who are we dealing with in this moment.
No, exactly. I mean, are you starting to sense that people are becoming just more aware, you know, as you were saying, as you know, we've been talking about of what white supremacy really, really is, and whether or not it is becoming normalized and hopefully deconstructed. Do you think that people get it? Do you think that white Americans get it?
I think white Americans are much more aware, particularly the ones in, you know, the millennials, the Gen Xs. But, you know, if you go back, and you don't have to go back too far, you can go back into the 60s, and you look at the newspapers where they showed the KKK marching down, you know, Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the Capitol. So this, in some ways, it's like a re-exposure to what has been normalized for quite a while, you know, in this country. And so the newness of the information is that maybe young people were not aware of how much this existed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, I wonder in the American schools, I did my entire education, including my graduate and postgraduate work at McGill. So I have never been a student in America. I mean, in the schools these days, you know, as compared to years ago, Are the curriculums dealing with the reality of what happened and what is continuing to happen? Are you aware of this, Colette? What is happening in our educational system today?
Well, you know, Bebe, it depends on which school system you are in. Here in Oakland, there's a lot of work that's done around anti-racism, and that's built into the curriculum, multiculturalism. But across the country, I don't believe that it's being looked at as much as it could be. I mean, you know, the 1619 Project, which is a curriculum that addresses the issues that we're talking about, there's so much pushback from not only parents, but politicians, leaders, even Mitch McConnell, you know, at his highest level was pushing back on the 1619 Project. So it's not really yet in the curriculum in a way that I think it would help young people understand how we got here and what are some of the ways that they can make, they can be part of making changes. But I do see a little bit of an opening where people want to have this information. And I don't know, are you familiar with Isabel Wilkerson?
I am not. Who is she?
Oh, she's a fantastic writer. She has a book. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning author. And she has a book. Her most recent book is titled Caste. And I think if any person, white, black, Asian, Latino, if you want to understand how systemic racism got embedded into our country, I think she lays it out very well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It sounds like that would be an important book for, you know, for everybody to read. You know, I felt very fortunate as a child. My father used to talk about mm-hmm. racism when I was a small child, and he was a writer, and he used to write for the newspapers. And I learned, maybe when I was 3 years old or 4 years old, we used to talk, believe it or not, about mm-hmm. segregation and what was going mm-hmm. on, you know, in the United States and in the South. And yet, growing up in Winnipeg, Colette, I never met mm-hmm. a Black child or a Black person. Until mm-hmm. I moved to Montreal and then Toronto. And I think that, you know, we were all very isolated. Of course, I also never met somebody who was an Indian. I mean, it was just, you know, you lived in your little spaces. And I think that it's just been such an important thing for all of this conversation to finally be coming out and to be able to, you know, find people. I mean, I feel so grateful that you were actually wanting and willing to talk with me, and maybe some of the questions that I, you know, would be asking would be naive questions, but you just stepped up, and I loved it, and I appreciate the fact that we have this opportunity to talk frankly about issues that I think that many people would be reluctant to bring up, white people reluctant to bring up with African Americans.
I agree. I mean, thank you. I welcome the opportunity because I do believe in my role as an elder. I turned 65 last year. My role in the elder, as an elder, is to, you know, put myself out there to have conversations because and to talk about the hard issues. I believe many white people have the elephant in the room, almost like an alcoholic system where you don't want to talk about the who's causing the problems in the family. We have a huge elephant, but I'm also, as I said, I'm a hopeful person. I do believe that, you know, people such as yourself, as other folks, want to have those conversations and not be ridiculed, not be judged. But if you haven't had opportunity to even hear yourself, you know, out loud, it's oftentimes difficult to change your thinking. And so that process of going back and forth. Now, I will say this because I do support it and I've made a different choice, but it's not African Americans' responsibility to educate, white people about how racism shows up. And there's a curiosity that needs to be cultivated, that they want to know more information so that they can begin to see how it is impacting their lives as well. And I think that's one of the fallacies. People think racism, white supremacy is only impacting, African Americans, but it does impact white families and it impacts all of our families here in this country.
No, for sure. You know, I can't even really imagine, I mean, what it would be like. You're pulled over and stopped by the police. In fact, that was, my husband had a situation a number of years ago where he was protesting along with Cornel West, the stop and frisk policies here in New York City. And again, as a white Canadian, I mean, what people are going through where you're looking over your shoulders, right? And concerned, am I going to be stopped? Am I going to be frisked? Am I going to be questioned? Simply because you're walking down the street and you happen to be an African American. I mean, the impact of that on young people and old people. I mean, can you talk a little bit about that and what that has done to people's mental health?
Well, I'm knocking on wood. I have not been stopped by the police. But I also know every time a police car pulls behind me, it's like my anxiety comes up. Anxiety comes up. I start thinking about, well, what if he stops me? I've got my registration in the car. I need to let him know I'm going to reach over there. It's just a whole litany of things about, okay, what's going to keep me safe? That comes up, and that's for me personally, but I also, you can just go on YouTube and see, video accounts of what happens to Black people when we do get stopped over. I also find myself when I watch the videos of white men who will say to them, no, I don't have to give you my ID. No, are you I'm not going to stay. You're not detaining me. And thinking like, wow, how'd they get away with that? And so just imagine, men, women, but let's just say men in particular, there's a certain intimidation factor that's designed by how police, interact with African Americans. Think about what it might feel to their own psyche after they leave, if they're allowed to leave. you know, what kind of dehumanizing behavior did they have to experience? What did they, as a man, not have to express in order for them to, you know, hopefully get through this situation without being harmed? And it's still today. I mean, even if there's just police walking the street, you find yourself kind of, stiffening up and hoping for the best. And there's even a sigh of relief once that police officer has passed by you.
You know, it's so painful for me, Colette, you know, to hear you say this, that you'll see a police car and your anxiety levels go up, and just as you've expressed yourself, and what may happen or what could happen, and do I have my license and do I have my ID? And I mean, I would think that across the board, I mean, the young kids in your area, do you feel that they're experiencing the same kind of worry, the same kind of anxiety? Am I going to be stopped? Am I going to be frisked? Am I going to be questioned? Am I going to be arrested? I mean, if this is the kind of thing that is going on an ongoing basis, I mean, mental health in your community must really, really be suffering and needs to be targeted in a positive way, where people are allowing themselves and where people have real access to treatment to be able to talk about all of this.
Oh, without a doubt. And that's part of, you know, I think you're moving into looking at also what's traumatic and what happens when people have experienced trauma. And I think our young people at this point right now are being traumatized across the board, whether or not they were the actual victim. There's also, as you know, vicarious trauma, but just hearing about it, learning about it, witnessing it. You know, I think about the young African-American woman that filmed the video of George Floyd's killing.
Right.
And pray that she is getting that type of support, so that this is something, it'll always stay with her, but also that it doesn't impact her mental health in such a negative way as she becomes an adult.
Do you find that people in your community are really verbalizing and articulating more and more the trauma, the depression, the anxiety, the anger, the pain that they are experiencing? And do you find that there are, they'll never be sufficient, you know, support resources, are people talking about this more and more and giving themselves permission to articulate all the feelings, whatever the feelings are, that are impacting them and their lives and their families and their friends?
Oh, I definitely see that happening. I think that, you know, this new generation coming up is having the ability to put these really deep and hard emotions, you know, into words. There's a number of newsletters, there's blogs that are beginning to express that for folks. And I think that's very important. You know, I grew up in an age, a number of folks, it's like, okay, you don't let them see you sweat. You know, okay, you got through it, so get on with your life. And that's not, as you know, from a therapeutic perspective, that is not the way to deal with trauma. People need to be validated that this is what has happened. They need to hear what should have been the correct way that they had been interacted with. But I do think that we're learning to find the words to express to each other, how did you feel when that happened?
And how do you feel about the Black Lives Matter social movement in terms of mental health benefits? I mean, do you feel that people are starting to feel more of a sense of empowerment?
You know, I think that's definitely the outcome. But I have to tell you, I am so proud of these young people. I am very proud that they have taken to the streets to say, no more. This is what you're doing to us. This can't happen. And so I think, you know, from therapeutic perspective that, yeah, that's very important to be able to express what is your reality and to see some things change as a result of that. Most of the African American movements were started with young people. I'm talking, you know, young people 16 to 30. When you look at the Black Panthers, when you look at the Civil Rights Movement, and, you know, I was doing a little research on Dr. King and Martin Luther King, and, you know, he started when he was 26 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he was assassinated at 39 years old. And so most of his young adult life was out there, you know, fighting for civil rights.
Mm-hmm. So are you seeing then more and more a sense of pride and of empowerment that our lives matter and we are going to go out, we are going to march, we are going to express, we are not going to sit back, and you need to hear us and you need to listen to our struggles and what we have to say once and for all?
BD said it perfectly. Yes.
Yes, that is thank you.
That is definitely what occurred.
I'm so glad it's happening though.
Exactly. And you know, I'm hopeful too. I see the allies that are coming out. I see, you know, people really beginning to recognize that this is real. And you know, I remember, you know, when I was doing some work and at a particular, you know, mental health agency, there was always kind of this judgment that you're just being too sensitive, you know, or this is, you know, or just that, no, I can't believe that didn't happen. Well, it's never happened to me. What are you talking about? And so I think even the mental health field has had an awakening that African Americans have been trying to speak to these issues, these concerns for many years.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly through the media are definitely starting to get heard and seen in a way probably more than ever before.
Exactly. Right. Well, you know, the country didn't make a turn in the civil rights movement until a number of the protests and the horses and the dogs were and the water hoses were shown on national TV. And that was kind of a turning point as people across it begin to understand. I think Black Lives Matter has definitely done, you know, very similar, and they've done it across the world. And it's, you know, I think we've also got to pay attention. You know, the world is watching us. You know, what is it that we're going to do?
Exactly. And I mean, I think that certainly, you know, what I've been noticing, and I would think that you are as well, that I mean, we're finally starting to see more Black and brown faces in commercials, not just the athletes and not just the Hollywood movie stars, you know, but on television and movies and in politics. And we, and do you think that this is making, you know, African Americans feel more hopeful about being able to, and I, you know, I use this term, and then I'm wondering whether or not it's really the right term, to sort of make it in what has been a traditionally white media and political world. Are people feeling more hopeful now?
Well, maybe I'm going to get back to your, about the commercials. In many ways, I mean, we've seen this before. And I think the comfort level, the people that are being comforted are not African Americans. It's being shown to other people to like, look, everything's fine. You know, we've got folks participating here. They're doing this. And then you still have the continuation of racist systems. So I get what you're saying, because I've noticed it myself, that there's quite a bit more. But that in itself is not an indicator, you know, are things getting better?
Do you feel in your heart, I mean, you've seen it all for all these years, do you feel that things are getting better? Or do you feel that it is just kind of a superficial coating that is making people maybe feel a little bit better about themselves? I'm talking about, you know, the white society, just for the moment.
I do feel hopeful. I feel hopeful because we are having the ugly, the conversations that need to be had in order to get down to the levels of truth. And so for that, and I do believe that as much as we are, as African Americans, you know, putting the call out, that there are a number of white allies and people of color that are also putting the call out, and they're willing to have that, have those hard conversations. And also with the idea is that at some point we are going to come together. Now, I think we as a country think we gotta be a blended soup. Everything's got to cook together and it's got to look the same. And that's not necessarily true. You know, we're a diverse country. We're diverse people. And that's some of the excitement of who we are. And it's about respecting and understanding, you know, the various ways that people are living out their cultural lives.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that at this point that both the African-American communities and whites are starting, and this is something that I had a conversation with a couple of people mm-hmm. a few days ago, and we were debating this. So my mm-hmm. question is that do you feel that we're starting and wanting to come together as human beings, or on the other hand, do you feel that there is an increasing desire on all fronts to continue to want to basically live separately?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So curious what your take on this is, Colette.
Well, you notice I'm kind of pausing a little bit.
Right, I hear it. I hear it.
You know, I'm pausing because the things that come up in my mind are like, what is in our best interest?
Exactly.
Who we are as individual groups. And how do we know when we have safety, you know, around us? Am I in a safe environment? I'll be honest. I tend to stay within my community, within my African-American community. Most of the nonprofits that I've worked for over the last, particularly the last 20 years, have been African-American focused. I find that I can be more effective when I'm working within communities that aren't African-American. There's a level of judgment. There's a level of questioning. Do you really know what you're doing? There's a level of, well, wait right. a minute, we don't do it like that. And so I find as an activist, I don't want to always have to explain why this is a strategy that's going to work, why it makes sense that when you're doing a Be Still retreat, as we did with the Black Women's Wellness Project, that it was important that people saw Black holistic practitioners, that they saw Black people that were into meditation. There is a level that's needed of for people to see themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, were you honestly, I really want to know this. I mean, we could have talked about it on our Zoom conversation, but were you surprised or taken aback that I had reached out to this group? Again, my husband, who's an activist, I mean, he spent mm-hmm. his entire life involved in this, you know, as an American, as a white American. But were you surprised that I was sincerely interested and not just, you know, to have a guest on my show? It was not just that. I wanted so much to be able to have an honest conversation. And I liked you so much when we met on Zoom. And I just kind of wondered, what did you think? Here was this white Canadian girl reaching out, you know, asking all these questions, you know, perhaps naive questions, you know, that you may wonder, gee, you know, where has she been all her life? But was there any hesitancy on your part to meet me and to talk about this and to come on the show?
Well, they're not surprised, but there was definitely caution in my
caution. Moving. Why?
Well, I didn't know who you were. I didn't know what kind of white person you were yet. I didn't know that you would have the ability and the willingness to have an honest conversation. Because that's not always the case. I felt that once I got on the Zoom with you, that there was an opening in you to have a back and forth that allowed me to speak my truth. And whether or not it, you know, resonated with you, this is what is real for me, and this is what's real for our community. And you know, Beattie, you got the show called Ask Beattie, so it tells me that it's that you want to explore, you know, different situations.
Well, I mean, that's for sure. And, you know, I've had, you know, some really, really interesting guests, you know, across, you know, various different disciplines. And I have learned so much. And I'm not just the teacher, you know, when it's coming to relationships and sex and mental health. I mean, I want to learn and I want to grow. And here we are in the midst of some major, major changes in this country. And I just want it. I really want it. And I want to continue to have conversations with you, you know, on the show, off the show, on the phone, on Zoom, you know, to be able to get to know you and to better understand what is really going on. And even more so, what, if anything, that I could do as an individual to be helpful in some fashion.
You know, I like that. I like that because this is not something, it's a complicated issue on both sides. And so it's not something, I think, you know, you for everything that we've touched on, you could probably go another 30, 40 minutes, if not longer, on that particular topic. And one of the interests that I have, and I think you as a clinician, is you're familiar with ACE, the Adverse Childhood Experiences?
Yes.
And how that impacts adult life?
Absolutely.
Well, I'm interested in that as well as, what when you add a layer of racism on top of that, you know, how then what is a treatment situation? What is the most compassionate way to assist young children on not having that brought into their adult life?
We have to listen to them and acknowledge their pain and their anger and their scare. Just like with any trauma, whether or not we're talking about early child sexual abuse or really trauma of any kind, to help people to emotionally process as best as we can, understanding, of course, that we can't change our history. You know, and that's the processing, the emotional processing that goes on or should be going on in counseling, not just, you know, using cognitive behavioral therapy to help people really work through all of those feelings. And it can't be done in a week or in a month.
No. And it's something that has to be intentional, because I think about the children and, you know, children are looking at their parents like, can you protect me?
Exactly. You know, listen, Colette, I'm looking at the time and I cannot believe, I mean, that we've been speaking now for probably about 40 minutes, and I want to continue this conversation on the show, and I will definitely, you know, I'll email you, and I want to continue to have a conversation on the show and off the show. And I just want to thank you so much for being willing, you know, as we've both been saying, to have honest, frank conversations about issues and subjects that most people, I think, may not have the chutzpah, the guts to be able to tackle. And I love you for it. And I just want to thank you again so much. And I'll be in touch. I'll send you the link of the show tomorrow. And to be continued.
Oh, definitely. And thank you. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for this interesting conversation. And of course, my mind is going like, oh, but we could talk about this and we could talk about that. So, yes,
we will.
I think this,
we will.
I think
we
it's
will.
A to be continued.
So listen, to radical love for all of us. OK, and I'll talk with you really soon. And again, thank you so much.
Okay.
Take care.
Take
Colette.
Care and thank
okay.
you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, interesting conversation. Wonderful woman. And of course, so much more to talk about. Well, everybody, an hour really has come and gone on the Ask Beauty Show. And again, I want to thank you so much for listening and for emailing. I'm going to leave you with my two weekly messages. And of course, the first is to do everything that you possibly can to do what is in your best interest and to love yourself. And of course, secondly, we all need to do a much, 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 much better job in learning to love each other. So goodbye, everybody. I will talk with you next week. Have a good rest of the day, and be well, and to radical love for all. Goodbye, everybody.